Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Day is episode 156, with the title, Speaking Truth to Power. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Saba Ali. Saba is a public speaker, a critical friend who champions justice for marginalised communities, focusing on intersectionality, cultural abuse, and the lived realities of queer South Asian individuals. When I asked Saba to describe her superpower, she said it is her ability to amplify marginalised voices into institutional change. Hello, Saba. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanne. Nice to be here.
Lovely to get you on. We first met a couple of years ago. We both did a panel together, didn't we? An online panel, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and we bumped into each other at events like Trans in the City. I think the Mayor of London had a event a couple of years ago. We bumped each other there. And more recently at Beyond Reflections Award Night, where you won an award. Hey, go you.
I did. I won allyship for the trans community.
Yeah.
Which was completely unexpected. But yeah, very honoured to receive that, especially as it was chosen from the community.
Yeah, I was thinking if you're up for an award, everybody else, no chance. Saba's got this.
Thank you. Yeah, no, we keep bumping into each other, which is great. Yeah. So it's always nice to meet like-minded people.
And it sounds like we're going to be seeing a lot more of each other through the RSA and some of the events and the LGBT community within the RSA. So I'm really, really looking forward to getting involved with those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I have definitely got you penciled in for a few things.
So if you listen to this and it floats your boat, if you're not a member of the RSA, firstly, join, become a fellow of the RSA.
Yep.
And then track either myself or Saba down and we can, get into that and find and get you in, yeah, basically.
Yeah, and I should add that actually, for those of you who don't know, RSA is the Royal Society of Arts,
Education and Commerce, or something, isn't it? It's got a long bit on the end, which I never remember which way round it is, but yeah. Of arts and something else.
Yeah, so me and Joanne are both part of their LGBTQIA network, which is doing some amazing stuff. Very excited to be part of that.
Which, and I don't want to focus on what's going on in the world too deeply at the moment, but there's a lot of stuff going on that we need to raise the profile. So it's a bit pooey out there at the moment, is it, for queer folk?
It's not great. I think that's one of the reasons actually why I'm really championing what the RSA are doing, because they are a global community. So the network is a global community. But I think at the moment it's so important for the LGBT plus community to kind of unite and get together and sort of try and put our differences aside and, you know, come together and work together. We really need to sort of support each other. And even if that's only in small groups, that, you know, we need to be there for each other at the moment. That support and compassion is so important.
Was there a point in your life where you thought, actually, this is my calling. I want to go and champion marginalised voices, talk about intersectionality. What was it, apart from being at the time, a young black Muslim woman with a queer tendency, I guess, apart from that, what got you into it?
So my childhood lived experience is actually child abuse and cultural abuse. So I have no recollection of the first sort of 9-10 years of my life. I know it was very abusive. I have like the odd, I don't really have flashbacks, but I had the odd recollection, and my mother was my perpetrator, and I know that she had mental health issues and she's passed now. And there were quite a few occasions where, you know, she just didn't like me for whatever reason. She, you know, like I said, she had her own issues. And I was a 70s child. And in the 70s, there weren't really any support organisations or groups. You had Childline and the NSPCC, and that was it. But obviously, growing up in a religious, conservative household, you know, what happened in the home stayed in the home. It wasn't discussed outside the home. And I think, you know, part of the reason why I don't have any recollection of those early years is I just lived in a fantasy world. Like, you know, I lived in a world outside in my head, sort of away with the fairies. And I didn't have any support at all. It kind of led me down a strange path. You know, I kind of got with the wrong crowd, got into the wrong things, eventually got kicked out of home because of drug abuse. But fortunately, I had people reach out to me, give me a lot of support. In the 80s, it was quite easy to, late 80s, early 90s, you know, getting on the housing ladder was a lot different to today. Priority, I managed to get sort of council housing. I mean, that's really in a nutshell. But what it kind of always, what I always said is that one day I really wanted to either help young children or help women that were kind of in my position, who didn't have a voice, who didn't have that support, but also to let them know that actually what happened to me was wrong. You know, it should never have happened. And I think, you know, the more I've worked in advocacy and I've worked around sort of hate crime, abuse, whether it's child abuse, domestic abuse, it's really made me realise that it's not acceptable. It's not okay. There's no justification for that kind of behaviour. And especially being part of the LGBT plus community, that intersectionality, that's kind of where it comes in. Because for me, you know, I'm a woman of colour. I grew up in a family of faith. I'm queer. I have hidden disabilities, so that, you know, I tick so many different layers. There's discrimination against all those different layers. So when you break it down, it's a lot to deal with. And I think people in the community, I've met so many people that have either been disowned by their family, or they don't get on with one of their siblings or their parents because of their identity. Or, you know, they get abuse from people at work or at school, or it can be in any setting. And it's just not okay. And I think especially as women of colour, there is so much, there are so many layers of abuse that we have to put up with. And so many people just suffer in silence. And I see it and I hear it all the time in the community. You know, people that will sometimes open up with me and we'll say that, you know, I haven't shared this with anyone before, or I haven't said this before. And, you know, I think my privilege is that people feel safe and comfortable to talk to me. But yeah, so I think just growing up with that lived experience, understanding what it's like to be abused, understanding all the different kind of emotions, trauma, the way trauma manifests into illness. So, you know, I have complex PTSD. I suffer with fibromyalgia, which is a trauma-based illness. It's understanding all those things, and it's kind of making someone aware of who they are, helping someone recognize who they are, love themselves, get to believe in themselves, and know that actually there is a way out. If I can do it, you know, I've gone from sort of being ostracized. I mean, I have a great relationship with my brother and sister now. I'm very fortunate that, you know, we've managed to rekindle that. But I think, you know, letting people know that I've been, you know, disowned by my family at one point, completely ostracized by my community have nothing to do with me. They still don't know how to address me or speak to me if they see me, which I kind of find quite amusing in a weird way. That, yeah, being ostracized by the community, having nobody, kind of, you know, being homeless, you know, a recovering drug addict, all those things, I've overcome all of those. You know, I've had years of therapy. I've spent decades working on myself. So I know that with a lot of hard work and support, you can overcome it. It's not easy and it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you know, this all happened to me in my 20s and I'm in my early 50s now. I'm 53. I'm not embarrassed to say it. I'm actually quite proud to say it because I never thought I'd get to 53. So for me, it's really important to share that message with people that, you know, it's okay. You know, we can get through this together. And the most important thing to me is I run a monthly support group for a charity I'm an ambassador for. Avengers, which is for women and girls. And one of the things that's come up for me, that really came up for me in the last session we had a few weeks ago, was most people that are victims, survivors, or have had some form of abuse, they just want to be listened to. They just want to feel some form of compassion. And I think in the community, we've constantly got people telling us, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. This law is for you. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. But actually, nobody listens to the community. And I think this is something that I do a lot of work trying to raise awareness as an ally for the trans community, especially. I'm very lucky that I have some really good friends that are trans women and men. Is that the trans community especially just constantly has people speaking on their behalf, speaking for them, speaking at them, and actually know, you know, your voice needs to be listened to, your voice needs to be heard. So those are the things that sort of are really important to me and what kind of brought me to where I'm at today in terms of using my voice. And where for the first few decades of my life, I was silenced and I was told I wasn't good enough and I was told not to speak and I was basically silenced. I will not be that person anymore. And I'm really proud to say that I am a defiant woman today. I'm not afraid to speak up. And, you know, if you want to call me a gobby woman, you can call me a gobby woman. But, you know, I've found my voice today and I will speak up for all those women and all those other people that find it difficult to speak up for themselves. So I could carry on.
Speaking as one of those trans women that you're allying to, It's incredibly exhausting having to continually do your own advocacy and standing up and protesting or whatever it may be. And there's so much, to quote a phrase, better together, or I think it was a Brexit term or a Scottish devolution term, wasn't it? Having allies to do some of that heavy lift, to clear the path, to sort things out, because privilege gives weight, doesn't it? And we called this speaking truth to power. As a trans woman, in many spaces, I don't have power. And as a non-trans person, as a cis woman, you have more agency in that space than I can. So to hear your voice in there allows me to sort of tuck in behind you and let you take the arrows in your chest, knowing full well that whatever I say is going to be used against me, dismissed, talked over, or the same old tropes and nasty remarks are going to come back out. But you can still go, no, that's not true.
Yeah, I do a lot of work today with the criminal justice system, especially with the police, as a critical friend. So that's basically speaking to them as a community member, not working for them, speaking to them in an advocacy role, sort of making suggestions or like maybe reading something saying, well, actually, you've missed this, or giving them advice on how to deal with the situation. One of the things that I do quite a lot is I always make sure that the trans community are included in it, but not just the trans community. I sat, for example, on the Met's LGBT Independence Advisory Group for 2 years, and it was all middle-aged white gay men. And I don't have anything against middle-aged white gay men, but if you're going to represent London, which is incredibly diverse culturally and in so many other ways, it cannot be represented just by white gay men that are middle-aged. You've got to have youth, you've got to have, you know, elders in there, you've got to have all the different strands of the community in there. So, you know, when I go and speak on a panel, or if I'm going to speak in a round table or in a scrutiny panel, I will make sure that I'm not just speaking as a woman. You know, I'm speaking as a woman, I'm representing different communities, but I'm representing faith, I'm representing race, I'm representing gender, disability. And because I have, you know, I'm so intersectional myself that I kind of do it without even thinking. So if I'm reading a document, I will think, well, there's nothing about disability in this, like that's completely missing. And that would just come to me naturally, not because I'm necessarily thinking about it, it's because that's how it is. And I've noticed that intersectionality is a buzzword that's used a lot at the moment. I think if you ask a lot of people where it came from, where the phrase was coined from, they wouldn't be able to tell you that it was Kimberlé Crenshaw and the meaning behind it, that it was, you know, civil rights word. And, you know, I don't know, people can look it up, they can do their own homework.
Yeah. Well, you could tell it's a powerful word because it's one of those words, along with microaggression and other words, yes, that the anti-woke brigade throw up as going, this is a mumbo-jumbo word. It doesn't, it's meaningless. Yeah. It's all about meritocracy and white people getting the jobs again.
Yeah. And in fact, microaggressions is another one. It's something that, you know, I'm acutely aware when someone says something that's inappropriate because, you know, I represent so many different strands and different... I was going to say label. I hate labels. I can't stand them. I don't like being pigeonholed because I don't know who I'm going to be or what I'm going to be each day I wake up. But yeah, to me, it's just really important to have that representation. To me, representation is really important as I have all those voices. And I don't think it's fair that any one person can speak on behalf of a whole community or any one person can say, I'm an ambassador for the trans community or I represent, you know, It just doesn't work like that. But the other thing as well, I just want to add quickly, is that anything I do in relation to, say, for example, on a scrutiny panel, giving advice, I will always go and speak to like trans organisations or contacts and say, look, this is what I'm doing. This is what do you think? Is there anything you want me to focus on? Is there anything you want me to particularly say? So I spoke at a couple of ChemSex conferences last year. And in the end, I agreed with a friend of mine, a trans woman, who recorded a video for me so that she could actually speak from a trans perspective and the use of chems. So when I spoke about it, I wanted to raise awareness of it, but it came from a trans person. And we did the same thing actually with a black gay man. I got him to record a video as well. So you talked about that kind of privilege, that yes, I do have privilege and I do have access to people and rooms. Is that when I go into those rooms, I will also bring those voices with me. So quite often that might be reading a statement out for someone or playing a video that someone's recorded for me. So to me, it's really important that I'm representing a community and I'm not there just representing Sabah because I'm not an community. I'm just an individual.
That's the amplification element, though, isn't it? It's making sure that you've created this space for people. You've crowbarred the door open. You've given a platform to somebody and you're there to say, go on, you can do this. I'm with you. Go girl or go boy. You've got whatever you can say or go them. And you can, that's what you need sometimes. You know, it's very lonely walking out into the stage in a spotlight on your own, especially if you're come from a background where advocacy doesn't come natural. Mm-hmm. You're going to walk away. And we see it all the time where people say, oh, I can't say anything. I'm too nervous. What if I fumble my words? What if I think I'm stupid or an idiot or something? So having someone behind you, giving you that strength, giving you that belief, I think belief is probably a good word there, that you are making sense. It's so powerful. It's so powerful. Yeah, and that's what you do, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of other people that do it, and wherever I have the opportunity to bring people into panels and groups and settings, I always do. I mean, I coerced you to come and join the RSA's Circle Network, and, you know, any opportunity I have where I can bring people in, like for me, collaboration is so important. I think, like I said right at the beginning, working in silos just doesn't really get you anywhere. That kind of like, I want all the glory and I want all the recognition, just doesn't work. You know, you have to work in collaboration. We have to work together. It's just a much stronger voice. And if I can give other people opportunities, why not?
I don't think actually you coerced me. I think you just said, here, Joe, I've got a cunning plan. What do you think? I love the cunning plan. Let's do it. Yeah, it was, someone described me as having the breaking strain of a Kit Kat. You know, my resistance is very low on many things, and I'm always up for something. You know, one of my mantras is always say yes, because no exciting adventure ever starts with no. Yeah, let's do it and see what happens.
Oh, gosh, I'm the opposite. You see, my favourite word is now. It's one of the reasons why I absolutely love being self-employed and working for myself. It's just that joy in being able to say no.
I get that. I suppose, see, I don't see those opportunities where I say no as a no. I sort of say, well, that's not a good fit for me, or that's...
Yeah.
It's all about what's in it for me. I'm not saying I'm doing it for personal gain, but some things that don't resonate, and I think, well, and I've been like you. I've said yes too many times in my life, you know, through that mantra. It's got me into sort of personal stress and overload and no time for myself. So I suppose I do pick and choose what I'm going to do. But if someone comes to me with a credible, cunning plan and it sounds interesting, I'm always going to go for it. And so, yeah, don't worry. I'm an easy target for you if you ever want to ask.
I've made a mental note. That's firmly locked away.
As a marginalised person myself, I guess, and coming from within marginalised communities, there's a huge distrust of the criminal justice system, the police, politicians, power in general, really, especially at the moment where we thought things were going to get brighter and sunnier with a change of government. It looks like we're recycling some of the same old tropes. Should people trust more, or should we still be doubtful and nervous?
Oh, I feel like I'm taking a big sigh. I really struggle with this because there are times when I've thought, should I really be doing what I'm doing? And then I kind of think, well, if I don't do it, who else will do it? And then I think, God, that's really conceited. And who the hell do you think you are? So I have this kind of constant battle with myself. But I think I've had other people say to me that I'm so grateful you do what you do because I wouldn't do it. And I've had so many people in the community say, I would not do what you do. But to me, you know, I do believe we need a police service because otherwise I think there would be anarchy. And I think I'm lucky because I work on the inside. I've got to meet so many good police officers and police staff. People that really genuinely do care and genuinely care about our community and marginalised people and want to help. You know, I've seen officers in tears, you know, really upset when, you know, no news broken about, you know, like when the Sarah Everard news broke, I saw officers in tears, like women up really upset. Stuff around the Barking murders, there was a lot of upset. And, you know, I've met a lot of LGBT officers and staff, and they genuinely care about their community. So in that sense, I just think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I think there's a lot around policing that the public don't see and don't know. I think there needs to be more transparency. I think the last government really, really corrupt. It's probably the politest way I can put it without using
morally and in other ways as well.
Yeah, they really were. You know, they openly said that they were going to use the LGBT plus community, the trans community, as a wedge issue, as, you know, culture, you know, going to make a scene out of it and cause problems. And they did, you know, that awful, vile Home Secretary, you know, she changed the laws just to make it difficult for trans people. And that's all they talked about. All they talked about was what was in people's pants. They didn't care about the fact that people couldn't afford to eat or stay warm or, you know, put their electricity on, turn their lights on. All they cared about was what was in your pants. And to me, it just beggars belief that people allowed that to be. Or when you think about, oh, God, I can't believe I'm going to even say the word Brexit, but when people are like, I'd rather lose my job and not have any money, but not be, you know, get my country back. You know, I just don't understand what's happening to this country, if I'm honest. You know, I do like politics. I really struggle with it at the moment. As we were saying earlier, I get so frustrated because I'm so interested in it. But then when we're in times like today, right now, I can't listen to the news. I can't listen to anything because it's not good for my mental health. But I think when it comes to policing, you know, they've absolutely ruined it. And we have, and I am going to say, we have such a far right leaning media who absolutely twist headlines and the information that's put out there. It's completely misinformed, complete scaremongering, and the average person that reads the news or listens to the radio is getting incorrect information. So I think, you know, the police are stuck in a hard place, and it sounds like I'm trying to make excuses for them. I'm not. But, you know, they're understaffed. They haven't got any money. They've just had funding cut. They've got more funding cuts that just happened. They're losing officers. Their long-term officers are resigning left, right, centre. They're in a dire straits, you know, and I really feel for them because people that, you know, I know an officer who was there for 31 years, a person of colour, really compassionate, really committed to community, did amazing work with the LGBT plus community. And he retired, took retirement because he was like, I just can't do it anymore. And people are losing faith. And that's because they're just being run to the ground. So in terms of why do I keep going back? Why do I keep doing it? I think because at the end of the day, our safety and our security is really important to me. And, you know, the few people that I have been able to refer and that I have put through to the police, whether it's been to do with stalking, domestic abuse or transphobic or homophobic hate crime, have actually been dealt with really well. And they've all come back to me and said, I actually can't believe how nice that officer was, or they actually treated me really well. So en masse, they come across as evil. But one-on-one, when you get that, you know, one-on-one, they've actually been like, I actually can't believe the police have been nice to me. So to me, that's what's important. You know, they have caught a few of the criminals from a few of the people that I've put through. And to me, it's important to have, you know, if I can be a bridge and I can be a link between the community and them, to me, that's really important. And that's one of the reasons why I started doing this work. And I kind of mainly started doing it because one of the things that I realised was that there are months when there is no transphobic hate crime reported at all. And I know that that's not true. And I know that when there's third-party referrals for domestic abuse, there is literally no reports for trans domestic abuse or sexual assault. And I know that that's not true. Hate crime reports are really low. So to me, I want the community to feel comfortable to report hate crime. I want them to report it. I want perpetrators to be caught. And the only way that's going to happen is if we can kind of build that trust and confidence between the two. You know, the community need to be able to trust the police, and the police need to be able to understand the community to be able to speak to them and communicate.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think the trust is low because you don't believe there's any relatability there, because you're, yeah, as a trans woman, as a trans man, as someone who's non-binary, you see binary police officers, you see cis police officers. So you've got very low confidence because, let's face it, being on the front line as a police officer, as a trans person, that's a pretty brutal place to be as well. You've got not only the discrimination against your uniform and who you are, but also your identity as well. So I guess any weakness in terms of, in the view of a perpetrator is an angle that they've got to overcome as well. So it's a pretty brutal environment to be in. I get it. But I reported a hate crime probably about 6 months ago. For some reason, I get random emails after I appear on GB News or do something on the media. I get people actually track me down and start sending me hate mail emails. They actually write to me. I think it's brilliant. I think I've created that much anger in them that they actually write me an email. And they've taken the trouble to find my email address. And this one was very vitriolic and it was very, very nasty. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll just go to online hate crime report, cut and pasted it, put all the correspondence in there. And they sent an officer around to have a chat with me. And you know what it's like? An officer turns up at your doorstep. They've got all their fluorescent gear. They've got their big belt with their cut handcuffs and their nightstick and their torches and their radio. They're quite an intimidating package when they turn up at your doorstep. They're like, whoa, can I come in? You think, blimey. And I feel intimidated already, like I've done something wrong.
Yeah.
Just the way they speak and their tone of voice. It's very authoritative, isn't it? Deliberately. And you're sitting there. There's no empathy here at all. I'm sat on my sofa. He's sat on the couch opposite. And I start talking to him. And he immediately had empathy, had compassion. He was looking through the evidence. This is so wrong. You shouldn't have to put up with this. This is absolutely abhorrent. We're going to do all we can to find this person and prosecute them or whatever we can do. And they left. I thought, wow. Despite that hard, officious exterior, there was a person in there that was there for me. And it restored my faith in that hate crime process, just the fact that this person was listened to me, actually listened to me.
That's so good to hear, and I'm really glad you had that experience. One of the things I kind of work with, I facilitate and advise with new recruits, sergeants, inspectors and above. One of the things that we do sometimes say is, you know, that the, you know, in some situations, maybe they need to go like in plain clothes so that they're not intimidating, as like you said, if it's something that they're not comfortable with, maybe ask, you know, does the individual want, would they prefer a man or a woman, you know, to attend, you know, to what does a victim survivor, or, you know, what do they feel comfortable with? So, you know, and that tone of body language, you know, it should be softer, it should be, you know, more compassionate. But, you know, and I mean, I always say, like, listen, like, please just listen to them first before you start filling out your forms and ticking your boxes, because listening is just the most important thing. And that's, you know, but I'm glad you had that experience.
Yeah. I dare say if I was less mature, younger, less robust, less resilient, less confident, I would have been very intimidated. And that's not the person's fault. It's just their persona, the way, that's how police are trained to be, isn't it? To be officious and an authority and a figure that you're feel dominated by.
It's a uniform.
It
is a uniform. Yeah. How did you feel afterwards then when they left? Did you?
I was very satisfied that I felt listened to. I felt that they cared. They were going to fight on my behalf, and, you know, they were going to champion my cause. As it turned out, they tracked the person down and they said this person has significant mental health concerns. And whilst they're not stopping me taking it forward, they wonder what would be come out of it. You know, this person was, does this a lot sort of thing. You know, it's, they didn't persuade me. I was happily guided to a conclusion where there was nothing practical to be gained. This person was just bored, mentally struggling, and it was more likely to cause more problems for me by pursuing them, because they would take vengeance on that.
Yeah.
I was happy to go with it. I felt a bit disappointed at the time that I wanted, after they persuaded me that, did I want to go to court? I went, okay, fine. And I was then on this ledge wondering if this person was going to do it again. Every time I appear on this show, are they going to come back? But no, they haven't come back so far. So, I felt satisfied, and I've reported other things in the past. I was asked to leave a bed and breakfast in Blackpool because I was potentially a disruption to the other guests, you know, in Blackpool of all places. You know,
they says, my goodness.
We've got families here, you know, we've got families. What are they going to think having you here?
Wow.
And luckily I knew a police officer in the Blackpool area who, I think was on the LAGO team at the time, that's what they used to be called. And I reported to him, and he went out of word and sort of, because I actually managed to record it, the whole conversation, on my phone at the time.
For you.
And it's pretty brutal. It's like, they're going, well, because I was there with my wife, Marie, and Marie standing next to me. And I was with a group of other trans women as well. We were having a weekend in Blackpool. We're all kind of very respectable, very chilled out. We weren't outrageous. And they said, well, we don't allow all sex parties in here. I said, well, here's a cis woman. And if you're playing the sex card, then we're not all one sex. And, oh, yes, but you're disruptive. You're going to be partying all night. Well, do I look like I'm going to party all night? I'm 50-something. It's like, I just want to come here, stay the night, have breakfast and do a bit of, and ride the donkeys up the beach sort of thing. And it was like,
Did you ride the donkeys up the beach?
No, I didn't. No. I was a bit too heavy. I was in excess of 20 stone. I think I'd have killed the donkey if I did that. So I got a good satisfaction there, because they asked me, what did I want? I just said, look, what do I want to come out of this incident? And it's always, for me, it's education.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for vengeance. I'm not looking for someone to be punished or have their life destroyed. I just want some education to occur. And the person just turns around and says, okay, I get it. Yeah, and I get it now. And maybe it won't happen to somebody else. So that's all the outcomes I've ever wanted, is just education.
Yeah. Do you know, you're spot on, and I absolutely agree with you. I'm a great believer in restorative justice and kind of resolving conflict in a peaceful way. And sometimes it's just a a learning incident or learning piece for that individual. It's not about causing them distress or trying to make life difficult for them. It's just helping them understand that actually what you've done is not okay. And, you know, I'm a strong enough person, I can handle it. But the way you've behaved, if it was someone that was already suffering with some form of depression or was suicidal tendencies or, you know, was in distress and you behave like that, you don't know the detrimental effects you could have on that individual, and that's not okay. So, you know, I love that, you know, you're strong enough to be able to do that. And I really applaud you for that, because a lot of people wouldn't do that. They'd want revenge. And I just think sometimes revenge isn't always the best way forward. It really is making sure that person can see, if they can see where they've gone wrong and why they shouldn't have behaved with the way they've done. Because I think in the short time that I've known you, or the few years that I've known you, I definitely know you wouldn't be up all night partying or having sex parties, as they say.
Is that what happened? I must have missed the invite to that one. No, I'm too long in the tooth for that now. I don't even enjoy drag karaoke anymore. It's like,
yeah, no, we can't go there, because that will go down a whole nother tangent, and people will end up hating me if we start going down the drag route.
I do like my karaoke though. I suppose since I stopped drinking, I'm not as outgoing as I was. But when I was drinking, I was always grab the microphone and try and do Jolene or something badly, or Suspicious Minds was always my Elvis favourite. That was always one of my go-to Suspicious Minds.
Oh, wow.
Because I was caught in a trap, a bit of Born This Way, a bit of Gaga, a bit of that kind of stuff. Yeah, all that kind of. But yeah, I did like a bit of sing like no one's listening. And then the people who are listening wish they weren't, because I don't have a voice. I have a scream, which is a. But I'm quite happy to express myself loudly and have fun. So, yeah. But no, I think sometimes we do get stereotyped. Is that in that, you know, the RuPaul Drag Race type act, or the characters from the 1970s? And everyone to their own. I mean, nothing against. In fact, I embrace people who want to express themselves in using drag as a performance and dressing up and doing what they do. Absolutely. I think there's some amazing people out there taking that art forward and express themselves and challenging people's perspectives. You probably know Daniel Lisswell. I met Daniel at an event several years ago. And what he does with clothing as a performance, as an art,
yes,
it's absolutely incredible. Stunning. I think he is stunning, isn't he? And not necessarily in a raw beauty way, but in a creation way. So yeah. The whole, everything is bespoke. It's a different outfit each time, and it's incredible.
Yeah, he upcycles everything he wears, and it's a working piece of art.
Working piece of art, yeah. And I had a great night chatting to him. I think it was at a Queer Britain fundraiser a few years ago I met him.
Yeah,
and I think because he's quite a tall person,
he's a very.
And by the time he puts all of his outfit on, he's very, very tall with all this outfit. And he was standing on his own, and I guess because he's a statue of art sort of thing, so he deliberately wants to stand there. And I just went and started talking to him, and I spoke to him about an hour and a half. We're just chatting away and doing the canapes and the drink and stuff, and it was. Yeah, I had a great hour with him, and I hope to get him on the podcast at some point. He keeps saying yes, but we haven't managed it because he's such a busy person.
He is. He's done. We've done some advocacy and campaigning work together in the past. So we've worked on a few projects together because he does use a lot of his art for activism as well. But he's got an absolute heart of gold, and he's so just. Like you said, when you look at him, you just wouldn't imagine it, but he's got one of the softest, most compassionate people you will meet, and absolutely huge, huge ally for the trans community. Really not afraid to speak his mind. You know, he really says it as it is. Have a lot of time.
He's very well connected globally, though, isn't he? He's done some work with rulers and leaders in Far East countries and across America, and he's had some amazing gigs, if you like.
Yeah, and he's incredibly well connected. He's introduced me to a few people as well. Yeah, he's amazing. In fact, he introduced me to Tyne O'Connell, do some stuff with her. So she does some incredible stuff. She's the British historian. So I know she's writing a book at the moment where she hopes to launch later this year on Melfrith, which will be really interesting. So we'll have to bring you along to that one when she launches that.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. So you're not coercing me. You're just offering me an opportunity.
Oh, no, I'm just telling you. I'm inviting you.
Yeah. I'm in.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is yet, but I'm in. Yeah.
It'll be a book launch for her book, Melfrith.
Yeah, that'd be fabulous. So going back to when we started this conversation, you were talking about some of your early childhood trauma, your mum, your mother, and your home environment. I was a trustee of AKT for a while, formerly the Algonquin Kennedy Trust, the LGBTQ plus homeless charity. And some of the stats they came out with are homelessness amongst young queer people, especially young TQ people, is disproportionate. And if you're black, intersectionally black, it's even more disproportionate. A lot of people, even in 2025, are being forced out to the streets, living with families that are toxic. How can young queer people or anybody who's living in that toxic environment get out? Because when we're young, our family is everything, isn't it? We don't know anybody else.
It's so difficult. I tried to run away from home when I was 15, but I got caught. It takes a lot. I mean, you've either got to be at absolute rock bottom to just walk out the door and leave everything. But as a young person, it's not like you've got a job and other support and things that are going to provide for you. But to kind of literally just walk out of your home and leave everything behind, that's really in a desperate state. There aren't many refuges. There's the Outside Project and Star Support? I think Star Support is the first LGBT refuge that opened in London, which sadly Mari opened, and she passed away last year. And I remember speaking to her just before she let me know that it was opening. We both used to be trustees for Gallup. So I used to be a trustee for Gallup, and that's how I met Mari. And I remember her saying to me that, they already had a waiting list and they were full and it hadn't even opened. I think one of the things that I'm really aware of, and one of the things that actually I've spoken to the police about is, where do we signpost young people in their time of need? Because there are no refuges or places for young people. Especially if you're queer, it's even harder because you've got that intersectionality. You've got, the homophobia, transphobia, where people, you have that added fear of coming out or being your authentic selves around people. There have been incidents of young people that have left home because of conversion therapy, because, if they won't conform to what their family wants, then they're going to be subjected to torture therapy. It's nothing conversion. It's not really converting someone, it's torturing them. Yeah. So it's a really difficult situation. And there's just not enough support for LGBT plus people out there, especially the trans community, and even more so for people that are marginalised within the community. So when it comes to disability, when it comes to faith, when it comes to race, if you add that on top of it, it's even harder. There's just nothing out there. And it's a conversation I've had a few times with a few people that, what support is out there? There's nothing. And on the back of, I think a few years ago, Gallup did some research, I think, when the whole anti-trans rhetoric really, when shit hit the fan, a few years ago, there were refuges that were turning away trans people because it was causing problems because gender critical people were turning up at their doors or people within the refuge didn't want them there. So for the trans community, in fact, this was about 18 months ago because I remember we discussed it an away day for Gallup, the trustees did, that, for trans people, even more so when it comes to homelessness, they have absolutely nowhere to go. So they either end up on the streets, they end up in, potentially could end up in sex work to get the money to kind of rent or stay somewhere or be in a, you know, an accommodation. But it's horrendous out there. It's really not safe at all. And there is nothing, you know, funding's being cut left, right and centre. Funding's being cut from institutions, let alone charities. It's awful. There is nowhere for people to turn. You know, we need more support. We need more homes. We need more services to be able to cater and support these individuals, because the situation is getting worse. And I follow a lot of work that Hope Not Hate do, just because I do a lot of stuff around hate crime. So, and I'm really interested in the work that Hope Not Hate do around the far right. And, you know, they said at the beginning of last year that there would be a rise of the far right and what they would do. And we've seen that. And we've seen, you know, in the last kind of couple of months, what's been happening in the media. And it's, you know, I sadly don't think it's going to get any better. I still think it's going to get worse, especially with social media taking away all the filters, and people seem to be more emboldened at the moment. And
yeah.
I don't want to say the T word, but with the T word back, he's just given carte blanche for people to do and say and behave how they want. We've got leaders on stages doing Nazi salutes, so it's not a good place. We need support, you know, which is why, to me, even if it's just meeting in a park or meeting anywhere or doing online support groups, being able to just listen to people, speak to people, knowing that they've got someone they can turn to and speak to, is so important, and why we need to come together. We need to sort of start working together.
It's sad to me that I see many people in the communities where we share, trans, queer, are making public statements on Facebook about them pulling off the platform. And yeah, I mean, people worry that it's going to become very toxic, but there is a lot of good in the groups and the private chats and the environments there. So I'm really keen, as I would call it, hold the rope. I'm not letting go. I'm not going to exit places like Facebook, because there's so many supportive groups, so many people out there that I know that they've got my back and we can talk about things. I think if we're not careful, what we end up doing is we end up being driven out of these supportive environments by these big glib statements. I think what we should do is just stand in protest and say, I'm not leaving anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. And I think, hopefully, Facebook won't become a tumbleweed zone for queer people, because there's a lot of private groups and communities out there that are safe spaces.
I hope so, because I don't really use Facebook. I mean, I haven't done for a long time. I can only manage one or two social media platforms. But I hope so, because I think that community-focused community groups is so important at the moment. The word chosen family gets used a lot, and I think at this moment, we need our chosen family. We need the limits and few around us, whether it's groups of two or three. You know, you only need one person to listen to you to feel, you know, like a problem's halved. You know, I do believe in that saying that, you know, problem shared is problem halved, because I do it all the time, and I feel better the minute I've let it go and released it. And, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily solving a problem. It's just being able to share it and telling someone that, look, oh my God, this is how I'm feeling. And knowing that someone's there listening to you, supporting you, it's enough in your time and need.
Big seen and heard is so. I often think about it. If you think about the analogy, blowing into a straw and blowing into a balloon. If you're blowing into a straw, there's no pushback, there's no back pressure, you've no idea if you're making a difference. But as soon as you pump into a balloon, you can feel it. So when you've got support, you've chosen family, you've got people around you, that even if it's just reflect, okay. I hear you, have a hug, have a virtual hug, tell me more. It's a way of really allowing yourself to sort of have that human connection, that human contact, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. What do you do to sort of unwind or have downtime or look after yourself? Because, I mean, you do a lot of stuff as well. So how do you...
I'm incredibly privileged that I've got a wife, Marie, who loves me to bits, and we are soulmates and best friends, and we do lots of everything together when we're not doing working stuff. But we work together. She's part of the business. So my mum is incredibly supportive. Yeah, when I transitioned 8-9 years ago, she's become one of my biggest allies, and she'll advocate for me. Our two children and their partners. Whilst they don't necessarily get me and fully understand me, we have a great family. So, We do Sunday lunches, we do family stuff, we go to the cinema. So I live in a very, very, very safe family unit. So, and I have an incredible network of business friends, who are, a lot of them are real friends around the world that I've built over the last 8 or 9 years. So I'm incredibly privileged that I have that network, and I've got my real family and my chosen family, and they're all together. And so yeah, for me, I'm lucky, I'm privileged, but I know many people who are isolated. Their home life is toxic, or there's a conflict there between who they are, coming out, having to behave in certain ways around certain family members. So yeah, whatever I did right, I did right.
That's so nice to hear. And it's so lovely to hear as well, because I think amongst all the doom and gloom, when you do hear positive stories, it is uplifting, and it does kind of make you feel warm that there is that goodness out there as well. It's not just all doom and gloom, and people are.
So Marie and I want other people to feel that way. So it's part of the Marie's, if you like, drive to work with me in the business is to enlighten the world that it doesn't have to be doom and gloom. I appreciate for some it is, but we want to rewrite that book. You know, the book that says you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose your car, you're going to be financially destitute, everyone's going to hate you, and always rejected. And we said, no, we're not having that book. We're writing our own book. And that's about how families can succeed. How just because someone comes out as trans, queer, gay, or whatever they come out as, it doesn't have to be the end of their life. And we give people hope, either with their traditional family or help them create a chosen family and have support, because living the lie or living in a box is not a future for anybody. They shouldn't have to live that way.
No, do you know, you reminded me actually of something that I remember having a conversation just a few years ago with someone, and they were saying one of the things that we don't do as a community is actually celebrate people when they do come out or when they do transition. We always mourn the loss that, like, you know, parents lost their child, you know, their son or their daughter, but we never celebrate the welcoming of a son or a daughter once a transition's taken place, or welcoming that someone's come out and celebrating their true authentic selves. You know, I think we need to do more of that in the community. We need to celebrate more and enjoy some times as well.
I mean, Marie often tells the story that when I transitioned, there was a real polarization between the support I got, which was really, very positive. Everyone's like, you're brave, the big hugs and go girl, all this other stuff. And Marie got the sadness. Marie got the, not too old. You could get divorced and find somebody else, and don't worry about it, you know, move on.
She felt just like told her.
So, no, it was like she even went for counseling with somebody who's trying to be able to get through this. And the counselor was almost like taking down the path of, I can help you get over this relationship and move on. And Marie said, no, I want you to help me get into this relationship and make it work. But that was 10 years ago. So I don't know if the counseling and support you get is better now. But no, Marie, if you talk to Marie, she always felt the one who was two steps behind. Everyone loved me and was like, didn't know what to say to her. It's like she was the bad smell and I was kind of like the celebrity. So it really was a problem for her. Maybe that's my personality type. I kind of owned it quite quickly. So, but no, I mean, now that's our drive is to try and show that this can work. Just because I'm trans doesn't mean to say I'm going to fit all the stereotypes that people can throw at me.
I actually know quite a few trans couples where they have transitioned and stayed together. I think I know about 4 or 5, and they're really happy in their relationships. Mm. Because I guess you fall in love with the person, don't you? The inside of a person, not the kind of outside. I don't know if that makes sense.
But it is a big ask. You know, if you look at it, what you're asking someone to do is question their whole sexual identity as well. I'm questioning my gender identity, but my gender identity has an outward impact on how they see themselves in public as two women or two men together, whereas they were seen as a traditional couple. Now we're seen as a queer couple. So Marie had to come out as queer, as bi, and she had to address her own sexuality. So everybody in a relationship wants or is able to or needs to make the change. So I can understand why it's hard for trans people and their partners to stay together, because we're asking everybody to reorientate who they are. Oh, it's bad enough for Phyllis Schofield coming out in a relationship. So, yeah. But it's a big, big ask. I think early on, I asked myself the question in my head, how would I feel if Marie transitioned?
Wow.
Could I cope? And I sat there and I would honestly openly say, I know I would struggle. Knowing everything I know, I would struggle to come to terms with it. I'm not saying I wouldn't come to terms with it, but it would take all of my personal thinking and support to make it happen. So, yeah, it is a big ask. And I think sometimes you just think, hard transition, you'll get over it and it will be easy. I respect the fact it's not easy and it requires work, like anything.
Well, she's definitely one to keep then.
Oh, yes, no, she's mine. It's not going anywhere. No, hands off, hands off, hands off.
she's a diamond. The Beyond Reflections event, I do remember. Yeah. She's really nice.
Yeah. No, she's one in a million. She's my one in a million, or our. We share each other. So no, she is fantastic. We live, love, laugh. We shout and scream and fight like everybody else. But no, it's a strong relationship. But
that's what makes it fun. It'll be boring. Yeah. It was just all kind of flatlined and.
I know. Yeah, you got to spice it up a bit. Sava, this has been an absolute fantastic conversation, and I can't believe we've been dashing for an hour or so. How do people get hold of you?
You can get me on Instagram. Or just Sava Celebrity PR. There's a whole other conversation for that name. Or you can get me on LinkedIn. It's Sava Ali and then followed by FRSA. So I use LinkedIn quite a lot. So that's a good place to get me. And then you can find out more about who I am and what I do.
The Sava, S-A-B-A, Ali, L-I. And there aren't many of you out there, so it's probably easy to find you.
Yeah. Just look for the kind of round head, sort of semi-shaved head. And it's
big glasses.
Yeah.
Yep. Love your glasses. They're great glasses. Love them.
Thank you. They're my computer glasses, actually. I've started wearing them. Otherwise, I get headaches because I'm useless at taking, like, screen breaks. And I realise that I'm sat at my computer for, like, 4 hours. And then I'm like, oh, my God, I haven't moved. It's really bad.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. And look forward to catching you up at one of the RSA circles. And anybody else who's listening right now, if you want to get stuck in, you've heard something here, contact Sava and you'll find more about these circles and all the fellowship of the RSA as well. So, Sava, thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean. I've loved it. It's been brilliant. Thank you. Thanks, Joe.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.